You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Brian Callen Show. Filling in here, Hunter Motz, while Brian Callen is doing the West Coast tour of one of his other podcasts, The Fighter and the Kid. If you're lucky enough to live in the West Coast, then, you know, in Las Vegas and San Diego and then in Hollywood, you may have the chance to see The Kid and The Fighter. So check out his website and see if you can make it out to see the other greatest podcast live. Ladies and gentlemen, I have the extreme pleasure to introduce a personal intellectual hero of mine, Professor Richard Nisbett. Just to give you a sort of broad overview of Professor Nisbett's work, he is probably the foremost expert on looking at how culture matters. You know, we had Joe Henrich on recently who talked about that from sort of, who's reviewing the latest work. Professor Nisbett, you probably know his work actually from Malcolm Gladwell's book. He did the research on the culture of honor and why essentially sheep herding mentality from Scotland is responsible for the South being so much more violent than the North of the United States. So, Professor Nisbett, without a further ado, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Probably the work of yours that has become the most famous, thanks to Mr. Gladwell, is The Culture of Honor. So why don't we start off by talking there, and then we can take a look at some of the other cultures that you've looked at, for example, East-West culture, and how essentially having different ways of thinking can make our lives better in your most recent book, Mindware.
Very good.
So, the culture of honor. So, there have been it turns out that for a long time, the South has had far higher homicide rates than the North, and there have been a lot of different explanations for that. So, why don't we start off by talking about what some of the different theories have been?
Well, one is just the idea that the South is hot, and when people have a hot temper, they do hot-headed things. So, one explanation is the South is hotter, and hot makes you at least aggressive, not homicidal. and actually, there is evidence that is the case. I mean, mm-hmm. there's some truth to it. The other major explanation throughout history, and it's been here since for 250 years, is that Southerners kept slaves, and they treated those slaves very badly. And this aggressiveness may have carried over to their interactions with other people, white people. So neither of these explanations is the explanation for the elevated homicide. You can get rid of the slavery hypothesis immediately by the fact that the homicide rates are much higher in the mountain South than they are in the plains South, where the slaves were. They didn't have slaves.
So the mountain South is places like Appalachia.
That's right.
And the plains South would be places like Mississippi, which is, you know, the heavy cotton belt where there was a lot of slavery.
Right, the moist plains. The dry plains also have very high homicide rates. But I'm sitting in Tucson right now, and I'm here to tell you that the heat in Tucson is a lot more acceptable than heat in Memphis or
right.
New Orleans.
And also, I mean, the other point that you make in the book is that the West shares highly elevated homicide rates, even though there was no history of slavery in the West.
Right, exactly.
So as you go through these different explanations, the slavery explanation doesn't make sense. It doesn't actually fit with the data when you look at it on a micro level rather than on a sort of macro level of talking about the South. And then the heat explanation also doesn't make a whole lot of sense because, I mean, presumably Appalachia is generally cooler than somewhere like Mississippi.
Right. And as I was saying, the dry plains of Texas and Oklahoma are a lot more comfortable than the deep South.
Right. So that leaves us with the thesis that you basically lay out in Culture of Honor, The Psychology of Violence in the South, which is?
That if you are in a culture where your economy rests on keeping animals, you can lose your livelihood in an instant. Somebody can let down the bars of your corral and take all your horses or all your cows. They can take your sheep one by one and leave you with nothing. So, or pigs, any animal that you keep is a much more portable than any other economic factor, any other way you can earn your living in an agricultural sense. You prevent that by making it clear that you're not the sort of person to be trifled with. Don't make any incursions on my property. Don't make light of me in any way. I'll respond to an insult with violence or the threat of it unless you take it back. And this, incidentally, is true of herding economies throughout the world. If you want to annoy an anthropologist, just say all herders are tough guys. They don't like generalization. And they'll sputter for a while, but they'll end up saying, well, I guess that's right.
And just to break that down with some examples, I mean, let's talk about some different herding cultures and some of the amazing natural experiments that have been done. I mean, for example, you talk about the Plains Indians.
Right. Plains Indians were peaceful hunter-gatherers until horses from the south, from the conquistadors, made their way north to the plains. And now your wealth depended on the number of horses you had, and the Plains Indians like the Sioux and the Dakota became some of the most fearsome folks in history.
And so, yeah, and if we talk about, you know, what are the sort of the great warrior cultures, you know, whether you'd want to describe them as warriors or I think some people, Brian likes to use the word psychopaths of history. I mean, you look at the Mongols, obviously they're a herding people. And even when they're not, you know, obviously South America, you know, when you look at Argentina and the Pampas, they're very macho cultures. But even, I mean, you know, there's a sort of a broader trend of these very sort of marginal agricultural lands. I mean, the Vikings didn't have very good agriculture, obviously living in the cold, cold north, and so they were forced to also raid a lot, and that's what the Vikings were essentially doing. And you find the same thing as well with the Arabs. So because we talked to Joe Henrich, who's, you know, now at Harvard, and you know, his a lot of the point of the is that, you know, a lot of these evolutionary beliefs, these cultural practices, are adaptive. So in a marginal agricultural environment, it is adaptive to be very macho, to be very aggressive, and to engage in these sort of raiding behaviors.
Right. Certainly if it's marginal in the sense that you can lose everything at the hands of another person.
Yeah, and so, and I, you know, as I read, I mean, I read through all of your books in preparation for this just again, but the, you know, as you look at, I think there, in terms of the culture of honor, there are two particularly relevant contemporary themes. The first is, obviously, the Arab world, where, you know, we have everything going on with ISIS and we have all of that sort of stuff, but you essentially, there's a long, long history of settled agricultural peoples, you know, clashing with herders. And it seems that some of that culture clash is now playing out between essentially what is a Bedouin mindset and the mindset of, you know, the developed world, which is, you know, much more settled agricultural, you know, let's trade, let's cooperate, let's have clear property rights.
Right. Well, of course, Arab culture is a herding culture for the most part, historically. Much of the Middle East is not really suitable for large-scale agriculture, but all of it's pretty suitable for herding sheep.
Yeah, and I mean, even when you look at the Quran, I mean, there's a lot of raiding that goes on. That was a fairly standard Bedouin practice, much like the Vikings. You know, if food supply gets short, you go in, you raid, you steal their sheep, their cattle, their camels. If things get especially harsh, then yeah, you can always go out and take from your neighbors.
Right. And actually, we're talking about the Arab culture of honor. Unfortunately, the U.S. military was not aware of who they were dealing with in the Iraq War. I mean, if you they drag somebody out of their house and throw them on the ground because of suspicion or suspicion of suspicion, they don't realize they've made a mortal enemy. That
right.
Person is now obligated to kill you, if possible. If not, then some other American.
Well, and I mean, I think also in the, you know, if we think about it in our own cultural context, you know, there are places where you could do that and places where it wouldn't work out so well. If you were to do that sort of thing in Massachusetts, you'd get one result. But if you go and do that in Appalachia or in Texas, you're probably going to have a much higher chance of retribution.
That's right. Don't even honk a horn in Texas if you can avoid it.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, you know, it's these. What I think is so interesting is that these two broad cultural strategies, you know, the whole macho culture of honor thing, you know, it plays out again and again in all these cultures around the world. And then you have these agriculturalists, and the clash between China and the Mongols was really a clash of those two mindsets. We're still seeing that in the United States between North and South, particularly over gun control, which is the other big contemporary issue that I want to talk about through this lens. And then obviously the Western world versus the Arab world. And when you, I mean, my parents live in the UAE and they lived in Libya and I was born in Saudi Arabia. And, you know, the Arabs really pride themselves on that Bedouin culture and that culture of honor, which, by the way, obviously we've talked about some of the negatives of that. But the positives of that, and again, this will sound familiar to people thinking in a Southern context, is hospitality. The Bedouins place a real, real value on hospitality, generosity towards neighbors, because today, you know, maybe all of my sheep die, and so therefore you help me out, but tomorrow it might be the other way around. And of course, Southern hospitality is something that Southerners really, really pride themselves on.
Right. And then there's also, the fact is, the science fiction writer Robert Heinlein wrote, an armed society is a polite society.
And I mean, it's so, yeah, let's talk about gun control, because essentially, if you're an agriculturalist, if you're a farmer, then, you know, your property can't move, and so you can have recourse to the government to settle boundary disputes or whatever. But your ability to protect your movable property, your sheep or your cattle, is basically, you know, based on your ability to shoot anybody who comes near them. And so I think that if you think about that culture of honor, it makes a lot of sense which parts of the country really are scared that the government is coming to take their rights and feel that they need to defend that with a gun.
Right. It is, for the most part, the South and the West, the regions where there were where there was herding was common.
And specifically, I mean, those herders in Appalachia overwhelmingly came from one particular part of the world.
Yeah, they were Scotch-Irish, especially, although there were Scottish people and Irish people as well. But the Celts have always been herding people. Incidentally, the Romans were terrified of the Celts.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were amazing fighters, including the women, by the way. I mean, so there are horror stories of being attacked by Roman soldiers, being attacked by 6-foot-tall Celtic women with their red hair and their flashing clubs.
And you know, so they came from, you know, that part of the world where there was not a lot of rule of law. The British weren't able to establish courts. Even if there were courts, the courts probably weren't very fair because they were, you know, from an imposing, you know, from the British rather than from the Scots. And then also there's the issue of movable property. And then they come to Appalachia. And of course, one of the things that Appalachia is most famous for is the Hatfield-McCoy feud, which is, you know, absolutely about, you know, the culture of honor.
Right.
I mean, the Hatfields and the McCoys are really, you know, ideological cousins of jihadis. They're not that different, right, in terms of their mindset and thinking.
Right.
But again, I think what's interesting is that, you know, the agriculturalists of the world, sort of the liberals in America, the northern part of America, have not done a very good job of, A, understanding the herders and the culture of honor to the South in terms of dealing with gun control. And then also, in general, America as a whole has done a terrible job at understanding the culture of honor within the Middle East.
Right.
And the irony of ironies is that the army, the U.S. Army, is overwhelmingly populated by people from the South. So you have these two cultures of honor that are essentially coming face to face with each other in places like Iraq and Afghanistan. And, you know, rather than finding common ground and really understanding each other, they've managed to antagonize each other.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, but I think the larger point, and I mean, I think our listeners should really take from this first book is that culture matters. And that's not something that has really been in vogue in academia for quite a while.
Right. As a matter of fact, when I started doing that research, I suddenly had realized, this is around 1990, that the kinds of scientific techniques that I was using to research human behavior in general could really be used to study cultural differences. But that was when political correctness was at its peak. So I said, I'm a white male. What can I do here to start doing cultural work? I said, I know something bad about white males, mm-hmm. which is Southern white males. By the way, I'm a Southern white male myself. I'm from Texas. So, and the reason I got started in all of this is that when I went to Massachusetts to go to college, I was struck initially by how rude people seem. I mean, the people in the Northeast, they still seem rude to me compared to people in the South and the Southwest. And after I'd been there for a while, the other thing that struck me is that middle-class people didn't kill each other in Massachusetts. But it did happen where I grew up. In fact, I have a relative who shot her husband.
Well, I don't know that I should be laughing at that, but and that is the interesting thing too. It's the types of homicides that you find in the South are of a very particular set and a very particular kind. Isn't that right?
That's right. As a matter of fact, there's a Southern sociologist named John Reed who's said if you stay out of the wrong bars and bedrooms, you're safer in the South than you are in the North. And that's because the type of homicide that's elevated in the South is strictly the homicides that are likely the result of an insult. So it's lovers' quarrels, it's neighbors' quarrels, it's a fight in a pool hall, but the kind of instrumental homicides, that is, I'm going to kill somebody because I can take their money, those are actually more common in the North.
Well, and which, of course, makes sense because the Northern culture is probably much more money-focused in general and about financial gain.
Well, certainly the Southerners have always held that against Northerners.
Well, I mean, that's the interesting thing is that a lot of these cultural prejudices, you know, probably reveal a certain amount of truth.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And the other thing that I found, one of the particular facts that I found fascinating in the book is that you said that in Texas until 1970, if a man came in on his wife in the act of committing adultery with another man in their bedroom and he shot them both, that it was justifiable homicide and he would not face jail time.
Well, I'm not sure that he could shoot his wife and get away with it, but the highest charge that could be brought against him if he shot the man was justifiable homicide.
And, that's pretty staggering, but of course within a culture of honor, it absolutely makes a certain perverse sense. And, you know, again, the people in the U.S. are often so shocked and indignant about the rules that you find in the Arab world, but they're not so different. I mean, they really do come out of that culture of honor mindset.
Right. No, Arabs and Southerners understand each other in that respect.
And I think the other interesting thing, too, is one of the things you talk about in the final chapter is about how women are complicit in maintaining that culture of honor.
Right, I'd say more than complicit. They're the ones who handle that mm-hmm. aspect of socialization. There's a wonderful quote from a Civil War soldier who was interviewed long after the Civil War was over, a Southern soldier. And it was obvious that the South was defeated long before the war was over. And a journalist said, why didn't you, just throw down your arms and get back home? He says, because of the women. We couldn't face the women. I love a quotation from Jackson, Andrew Jackson's mother. He was from Tennessee. And she said, never sue anybody for slander. Handle that case yourself. and he was, he actually was documented to be in 100 violent quarrels, and one of which he killed a man. Sam Houston was also from Tennessee, and his mother gave him a ring on his 21st birthday, inscribed with the word honor inside it, and gave him a musket, and told him, remember that I would rather all my sons were buried in a common grave than to hear that one of them had turned tail in battle. That was Mama.
So, I mean, absolutely. And, I mean, you know, in fact, I mean, I'm reminded as well, I think it was the book The Lion in the White House about Andrew Jackson. You know, much of Jackson's presidency was derailed by a question of honor. He was basically, there was the, what was it, the petticoat scandal or whatever it was? All about Margaret Eaton, and he was trying to defend the honor of this woman, and it basically created a huge rift in his White House, and he was not able to functionally pass much legislation.
Right. You know, I just got through reading a biography of him, and I don't remember that, but I'm sure you're
yeah,
right.
Yeah, no, it was the petticoat, I think it was the petticoat affair.
Right.
But it's, yeah, essentially what happened was is that, you know, there had been issues with Jackson's own wife, where she may or may not have still been married or something like that. I can't remember what it was. But at various points, Rachel Jackson's honor and integrity had been called into question. And so,
oh, right. I remember now.
Yeah. And there was this woman, Margaret Eaton, who had a similar situation. And Jackson, it seems like, essentially played out the script of his own issues with, you know, Rachel. And clearly from what you just said, I mean, you know, he was very into defending the honor of women at all costs. And it may not have been fair in Margaret Eaton's case. I mean, Margaret Eaton may have, you know, acted incorrectly or with impropriety or whatever it may be, but it split the cabinet because Dolly Madison and all of the other women in the White House wanted nothing to do with Margaret Eaton because they felt that she was low. And, you know, Jackson rushed to her defense. And so, you know, a lot of there were large parts of his presidency where nobody was on speaking terms. But, you know, I mean, which, you know, again, to a sort of agriculturalist northern mindset, seems nuts.
Yeah. No, people regard each other as crazy. By the way, southerners, when you tell them about this difference, they say, God, I didn't realize that northerners were such wimps.
Yeah, exactly. And, I mean, again, I think, you know, if we think about the Arab context again, you know, there's so often this, you know, judgment from a Western perspective of that behavior and tendency to create a narrative where it's like, look at how terrible these Arab men are to these Arab women. But these cultures of honor are, you know, in large part also perpetuated by the Arab women. And the stories that you've told certainly mesh with what I've seen where, you know, the women really drive this too.
Right.
But I think that's the interesting thing is, I mean, you know, I think in some senses the Republicans are right in the sense that we are really paying the price for political correctness in the sense that we don't get to talk about these cultures of honor and really take a look at where they make sense. And there have been periods in American history, certainly in world history, where those questions have been on the table. I mean, for example, the United States used to have a strong culture of dueling. But, you know, through conversations, you know, that has now largely been wiped out.
Right. Yeah, it was gone. It was there in the North early mm-hmm. on. But it became passé in the North long before it did in the South.
Right. And so that, you know, that was the, as a white man that, and a Texan, you know, that was a question that you could really look at and really examine and, you know, culture of honor. The psychology of violence in the South really did that. But from there, you've really expanded and you've gone to look at a lot of other areas of culture, notably, you know, in the geography of thought, how Asians and Westerners think differently. You know, you take a look at, you know, the differences between Eastern and Western thought and what the consequences of those are. And I think one of the most telling and one of the most interesting is why so much original groundbreaking science comes out of the West, but why Asians, you know, seem to dominate fields like engineering.
Right. Well, the broad generalization here that I make about the way people think differently in the East and in the West, and by East I mean primarily Confucian cultures, China, Japan, Korea, as compared with the West, Europe, especially Western Europe and North America.
Mm-hmm.
Westerners tend to be analytic. They focus on one particular object, something that they want to control or get something from. It could be a human being. Look at the attributes, use the attributes to categorize the object, and then figure out what rules apply to those categories. And Westerners are sort of constantly modeling the world with respect to how they might deal with it appropriately, how they might influence it, how they might achieve something. Easterners are much more broad-gauged in their perceptions and in their cognitions. That might, they view the world holistically. They view that object in its context, and they are concerned with relationships and similarities, where the Westerner is concerned with categories and rules. The most single striking experiment that we've come up with showing this is that we show underwater scenes to Japanese and Americans, and they're 20-second animated scenes, and then we ask them what they saw. The Americans say, I saw three big fish swimming off to the left. They had white bellies and fins both on top and bottom of their bodies. Japanese overwhelmingly start with context. They say, I saw what looked like a stream. The water was green. There were rocks and stones on the bottom. There were three big fish swimming off to the left. Amazingly, Easterners pick up 60% more information about the context out of this kind of scene than Westerners do, and they pick up twice as much in the way of relationships between animate and inanimate objects. And they do this at no cost to their perception of the object. I mean, they pick up just as much about the most salient objects as the Americans do. So it starts with perception, and it goes all the way to every imaginable kind of cognition. I mean, how do we handle law? Well, law you should look for unique solutions that have to do with the nature of the conflict between two people or with the nature of the crime. Americans, Westerners in general, you categorize what kind of crime was it or what kind of dispute is it, who's right, who's wrong. It's split the difference is the motto in the East, whereas it's winners versus losers more likely in the West. Context extends even to temporal context. There's a wonderful quotation from Zhou Enlai, a Chinese premier, who was once asked whether he thought the effects of the French Revolution were good or bad. And he said, oh, it's too soon to tell.
And this is nearly 200 years after the French Revolution.
Right, exactly.
So, the interesting thing is that it's not that, so you have this very, just to simplify things down perhaps even further, you know, the Western view is very individualistic, and the Eastern view is very holistic.
Right.
And it's not that the opposing viewpoints didn't crop up in the other context. So, you know, Mozi, right, came up with something that was very sort of Greek, Aristotelian, but it died in China. It never really took off. Confucianism was much more popular.
Right. I mean, it's amazing to Westerners to know that China, which, of course, is one of the world's great civilizations from the word go, and they made tremendous strides in in algebra, but they never got anywhere in geometry,
mm-hmm.
because geometry requires logic, and logic was never a part of formal logic, was never a part of Chinese thinking, except for that brief period that we're referring to with Mozart, who did have some interest in logic, but he never formalized it. And it's amazing to us that that's just absent from the Eastern tradition. And you find it even today. We compared University of Michigan sophomores with Seoul National University sophomores on their ability to solve problems that required logic, but they weren't just all A's or B's and all C's or D's. It was logical problems embedded in real life problems. If you give them purely abstract form, Seoul University students and University of Michigan students do about equally well. But if you embed it in real world problems, the Korean students are much more likely to be drawn to an incorrect answer, incorrect from a logical standpoint, because it's plausible from an everyday life standpoint. So you find it even in everyday life, and certainly in science. And to get back to the question you started with here, why has the West been so successful in science? Well, two reasons, I think. One is science is all about rules and categories. If you're not thinking about things in terms of rules and categories, you can't get science off the ground. And the other is the role of logic, because logic plays a role in science as well. And for some reason, we don't really know why, although I have hypotheses, the ancient Greeks just started thinking differently from the way anybody else in the world thought. They prized logic over experience, to a degree actually that seems crazy to us. I mean, everybody knows the Zeno's paradoxes. I mean, movement is impossible, because think of an arrow. If it were to come from your bow to the target, we would first have to go halfway between you and the target. Can we agree about that? You say, well, that's true. And then it would have to go halfway from there and the target. Can we agree about that? But, okay, that goes on infinitely. So, therefore, motion is impossible, because you can never get from here to there. You can only get halfway from here to there.
Sounds like a lot of modern economics.
Yeah, actually, I really do. I think that you can parody the Western ways of thinking, just as you can parody Eastern ways of thinking. But I think it's easier to mock economists with this than with any other academic group. I mean, they give them a premise and they'll drive all sorts of things from them logically, and you say, well, wait a minute, well, what actually goes on there?
And I mean, I think that's the thing is that, obviously, if coming from as children of the Enlightenment, we have a tendency to think that logic is the be-all and end-all. But it really, I mean, there are a lot of problems that come out of with this obsession with numeracy. I mean, the Vietnam War was fought by the numbers. And, McNamara in The Fog of War talks about how at the end of the day, the reason why we lost was a failure of empathy. We'd failed to understand that, the Vietnamese were really fighting a war of independence, that they were going to be willing to do almost anything for that. And, I was actually just in Vietnam and went to the Cu Chi tunnels. And you see what these people did. I mean, it's incredible. I mean, they built this massive tunnel complex right outside of what was then Saigon. And in the middle of the night, the Americans, who had a base not 5 feet away, kept on getting attacked. And they couldn't understand how are these people attacking them at night and then disappearing, and they couldn't find them. And it's because they tunneled right under their feet. This massive, massive complex of tunnels. And they repurposed bomb shrapnel to become spikes for booby traps. I mean, they were willing to do anything. And the Americans, McNamara, for all of his data and all of his numbers, didn't understand that, because he looked at the world so logically that he missed the context and he missed the common sense. So again, logic really does have its problems and does create these situations where, you know, like Zeno's paradox, you can conclude something that is quite obviously insane if you just look at what's in front of your face.
Right. Well, the Japanese literally will think that someone who is overly concerned with logic is quite immature. I mean, you wouldn't expect that in the West. I mean, for someone to be regarded as foolish because they're too logical.
And you know, I mean, also in terms of thinking about the outcomes of that, you know, engineering is a very, very holistic thing, right? You can't just, you know, in isolation, look at one piece of the bridge. You have to consider, how does the bridge interact with the rock on which it's built? You know, how do the various parts, I'm not an engineer, so this is not going to be a very well drawn out analogy, but, you know, how do all the parts fit together? Because if you look at something in isolation, you can build something that ends up falling over.
Yeah, that's actually a new idea to me, that engineering is more congenial to the holistic approach than many scientific questions. I think that's true.
And I think that's the interesting thing, too, is that, you know, I mean, we look at, I mean, the U.S., we really want more engineers, but it may be that part of the reason, I mean, there's this, usually the narrative that you hear about why there are so many Asian engineers and why we struggle is because they're willing to work harder, but it may also be that temperamentally, you know, engineering is a more appealing profession to them. Than it is to Westerners.
Well, they're also more likely to be scientists in this country. I mean, because the hard work also is valuable for science. In fact,
hard
work is pretty much valuable for everything. And that's why Asians, people of Confucian Asian cultures, are doing so well in the West. As Woody Allen once said, 80% of success is showing up.
Yeah.
That's
I mean, and that segues nicely into, I mean, I've spent the last 10 years working in education, and essentially the conclusion that I've come to is that the problem is cultural. And, you know, came to that by a very roundabout way. I would work with students and I would hear them say, oh, I don't have a natural ear for languages, or I didn't get the math gene. Basically, all of these beliefs that it is something fundamental and innate.
Right.
And I think that this really fits very nicely with The Geography of Thought, your book on the differences between Asian and Western thinking, because in particular of something called the fundamental attribution error. Now, would you mind explaining to our listeners what the fundamental attribution error is?
Sure. Well, it goes back to this issue of object versus context. I mean, Westerners are looking at that object and ignoring the context. This sets us up for all kinds of errors in everyday life. I'll explain. You do something that seems to me generous, and I think you're a generous person. And I don't look at the total context. I mean, that maybe you're in an office where everybody was doing that same thing. We don't recognize the role of social influence on our behavior. I'm in a book I just wrote, the book Mindware, which we may talk about later. I sort of lampoon myself by all of the things I've done. In retrospect, I can see that there's no other explanation except social influence. I mean, I took up tennis at the same time everybody took up tennis. I took up cross-country skiing at the same time everybody did. I dropped tennis when my friends dropped tennis. I dropped cross-country skiing when they dropped it. I took up fondue parties. Everybody's going to do it in the last, and everybody stopped doing it. I stopped doing them. I mean, I bought a Saab when a lot of people were buying these safe Swedish automobiles and so on. Easterners, they're actually more susceptible to social influence than we are. They're less individualistic. They're more controlled by their environment. That can be a disadvantage. But one advantage is that when they do something because of social influence, they're aware of it, and in a situation where we might not be.
Well, so, because it doesn't fit with our self-concept, right?
Right.
I mean, the idea that I, you know, homo economicus, king of rationality, you know, he who has bestrode the world and, you know, wrestled it to the ground, should be influenced by other human beings. I mean,
right.
It offends my sense of individuality.
Exactly. I mean, my joke is that, you know, I'm the hero of my constantly being written novel. Here's Dick Nesbitt walking across the parking lot. I mean, it's just, and in fact, you can show that East Asians don't think of themselves as the stars of their movies or the protagonists of their novels so much as one of the cast members. There's a very clever study that someone has done asking people to draw their social network, draw yourself and draw your links to other people who are close to you and the links among themselves. And Westerners draw themselves larger circles. My circle is bigger than your circle. And they put themselves in the center of this sociogram. Easterners are quite likely to put themselves off to one side.
That has real consequences. I mean, Adam Grant, this is, you know, the problem with reading all these books is you read these books, but then you're like, oh, but then they were citing someone else's study, and then you don't remember who the person's study is. But the Adam Grant, in his book, Give and Take, cited this study, and I can't remember who did it, but essentially there was a pretty strong correlation between the size of the picture of the CEO in the company prospectus and how selfishly they acted.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Apparently in Jeff Skilling's picture was huge and appeared on many pages. There are real consequences to this, you know, thinking that the whole master of the universe psychology that, I mean, it's Western psychology taken to the nth degree. That is really Wall Street.
That's right. I'm gonna lay that on the economists more than the psychologists. I mean, you know, greed is good. That's not that far away from what an economist will tell you. And in fact, economists, well, right, economists have always assumed that everybody would free ride when they get a chance. That is, take advantage of the common good. Economists are much more likely to free ride when you set up a situation than other people are.
And to go back to the fundamental attribution error, one of the other things you talk about in Mindware, which is your most recent book, is you talk about Bill Gates, where, you know, there's, and again, like Gladwell talked about this in his book, 10,000 Hours, but, you know, there's the situational interpretation of Bill Gates' success, which is that, you know, late 70s, right, he had access to a supercomputer or, you know, a very powerful computer when almost no high school students had that sort of access. And so, therefore, he was in a very small group of people who had the potential to found a company like Microsoft when, you know, computers were getting powerful enough and cheap enough that people could have a home computer. And then there's the general Western narrative where we don't like to think about context and luck and, you know, opportunity, and instead would much rather focus on the idea that it's because of something innate to the person, that he is a magical man, he's a genius, and that, you know, that is why he succeeded.
Right.
But,
and to get back to an earlier point that you made about education, I mean, this is hugely important for understanding why it is that Americans don't do as well in academics as Easterners do, and why people of Eastern culture in the U.S. do much better than people of European culture. When I was in, fifth grade, I started having trouble with fractions. And so my parents say, well, you know, Nisbets have never been much good at math. Well, it's hard to imagine a Chinese tiger mother saying that.
Yeah.
Fongs have never been much good at math. Even if Fongs have never been much better, you are going to be very good at math.
100%.
That's
and,
right.
And the fascinating thing is that, you know, in the West, we tend to focus on, you know, education being a resource problem, right? We're going to spend enough money and, you know, we're going to select out the geniuses and all of that sort of stuff. But the United States is typically in the top 4 in per student spending in the world. And yet we're routinely beaten by cultures like Vietnam. And I will tell you, having worked with lots and lots and lots of students, that American students don't do things such as open their textbooks, ask their teachers for help, look things up online when they don't know them, look at their mistakes, you know, write out their working on math problems, check their work, you know, start an assignment, you know, more than 3 minutes before it's due. I mean, there's a whole set of behaviors that if we would change these behaviors, then we would get very, very different results.
Right. And actually, Carol Dweck, who's a
is amazing, amazing yeah. work. We interviewed right. Carol Dweck on this show.
Aha. Okay. So, well, I'll just remind your readers then that she's shown if you can convince kids, and especially this is important, poor minority kids, that their intelligence is under their control to a substantial extent, it will dramatically change their behavior. So it's our mistaken belief that talent is strictly innate is curable, and Dweck is, and others have shown what big effects you can have by convincing people of that fact.
And that shows up, I mean, so the book that I co-wrote, The Straight A Conspiracy, basically takes all of that research, and it's people like Dweck, the work on stereotype threat, you know, Kahneman's work on heuristics, the 10,000-hour rule, and specifically the work that's been done on deliberate practice, which is all about looking at mistakes, and, you know, synthesizes that into a single book for the disgruntled teenager to change what they believe. But I think that's the really amazing thing is, you know, the geography thought is really, you know, understanding how it is that we have emerged with this culture where we believe in the idea of innate ability. And it seems to really be the unfortunate side effect of individualistic thinking.
Right.
And I mean, I think what's fascinating is that, you know, we talked about Bill Gates, but you see these genius myths cropping up again and again and again in Western culture. You know, Mozart composed his first masterpiece at 5. Well, you find out that the first piece that most people would call a masterpiece wasn't composed until he was 21, after 18 years of practice. Mm-hmm. You know, Sir Isaac Newton discovered gravity in an instant when an apple hit him on the head. Well, he worked on it for 20 years before he came up with it. You know, the math to describe it. You know, Thomas Edison invented the light bulb. No, he didn't. It was invented 45 years before he was even born, and he set up the first industrial research lab to, along with a whole bunch of other people, improve the filament to the stage where it would last.
Well, and of course, he has the great quotation that underlines what you're just saying now, that genius is 95% perspiration and 5% inspiration.
I think it was even 99-1.
I think it may have been.
but the point is that, you know, and I mean, the really, really, I mean, it's, yes, we have to change our thinking, but first we have to acknowledge that our thinking matters and that culture really does matter. It has consequences, and we have to get comfortable talking about the fact that culture matters, which we are, I mean, certainly in the 1960s, that was not the case, but now there has started to become a shift, and you have helped pioneer part of that shift. The shift to being comfortable and acknowledging the fact that culture does matter.
Oh, right. Yeah. No, I think people, if you've got a fact, people don't get annoyed at you. I say Westerners are analytic, Easterners are holistic, and then I quickly give them a couple of facts, and they're interested. I mean, and political correctness sort of will fade away pretty quickly, actually. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, once you're talking real facts of some interest about cultural differences, people can fairly easily give up their rigidity and fear of that, discussing cultural differences.
Well, and I think also, I mean, you know, I think it requires a couple of things that you do really well in all of your books. I mean, certainly, yeah, being empirical, you know, and I mean, you know, just a lot of good science, you know, really examining other hypotheses. Do they make sense? But also there's a real specificity. There's a real cross-culturalism, right? So, you know, in the culture of honor, you don't just look at Southern culture, but you also say, you know, we can see this as a pattern in other places in the world. And then, you know, also a real specificity. I mean, the danger is that, you know, I mean, if you look at why did cultural moral relativism and political correctness develop, it was in response to a sort of broad-based cultural imperialism, you know, that was practiced in the 1900s. But, you know, as opposed to being very specific, you know, embracing your mistakes is going to serve you much better than avoiding them. You know, practicing and actually trying in school is going to serve you much better than not doing that.
Right.
And I think that's the thing. I mean, you know, I think, as you say, I think that, that political correctness and moral relativism are going to die pretty quickly. And it's a result of, you know, people like you, and I think maybe even especially you, you know, really laying the groundwork. And then there are people like Joe Henrich who are taking your work further and, you know, looking at it in a different context. And, you know, Carol Dweck. There's more and more ways in which this problem is being attacked from different angles so that we can finally have that conversation and start to really fix some of these issues.
I agree.
Professor Nisbet, it has been an absolute honor and a pleasure to talk to you. For our listeners, all of his books will obviously be listed in the episode write-up. But, I mean, just a few for you to, you know, mull over: Culture of Honor, The Psychology of Violence in the South, The Geography of Thought, How Asians and Westerners Think Differently and Why, a book we didn't even get to talk about, which is particularly relevant in terms of education, Intelligence and How to Get It, Why Schools and Cultures Count, and then his most recent book, Mindware. I actually really wish we'd gotten to talk about Intelligence and How to Get It, because the stuff that you talk about with IQ is fascinating. And one quick thing that I do want to throw our listeners' way to think about: so we often talk about the heritability of intelligence, and it turns out that there's a huge difference between how heritable intelligence seems to be in wealthy families and in poorer families. Could you talk to us a little bit about that?
Right. It turns out that if you look at upper middle class families and you look at the degree to which IQ is heritable, you find it's highly heritable in upper middle class families. But it's not very heritable at all in lower class families. Now, why might that be? Well, essentially, I argue, upper middle class environments are all pretty much alike. They're optimal for developing intelligence, and they don't differ that much. I mean, Lawyer Smith's family is pretty much like Dr. Jones's family with respect to the kinds of things that go on in the home and in the neighborhoods that they live in. But at the other extreme of the socioeconomic ladder, some families can be as effective at socializing for intelligence as you would find in any upper middle class family, but you can also find lower class families that are chaotic and disruptive in every sense. So when you have huge environmental variability, that's what's going to be driving the bus with respect to IQ. Your genes just don't matter that much. It's these huge environmental differences. This, of course, has a very optimistic implication. If you can improve those environments, you could increase the intelligence substantially of people in lower socioeconomic status families. And we know that that's the case. We know that you can do it. Adoption of a lower SES kid into an upper middle class family is worth 15 to 18 points in IQ. That's huge. That's the difference between somebody who may or may not finish high school and somebody who will almost surely go to college. It's very important to know that the heritability of IQ does not pose limits to how much you can improve IQ at the bottom.
And to put some numbers on that, I mean, it's essentially, to simplify, 70% genes for wealthy families, but only 10% genes, so 90% environment for poorer families.
Right.
And on top of that, also it turns out that IQ is just one factor in predicting academic performance. Again, a lot of it is hard work, tenacity, stick-to-itiveness.
Right. In writing that intelligence book, I mean, I found out a lot of interesting things about intelligence that I don't think had been known before. But one of the things I got more and more persuaded by is that, hark back to the difference we were talking about between Easterners and Westerners, I think if I had to choose between a kid being super high IQ and super high self-control, I'd go for the self-control.
Right. And self-control is really something that can be developed and can be learned, and that is something that has been known. The Romans knew it, the ancient Chinese knew it. I mean, it's been known for a long time.
Right, and actually research is going on at Michigan now and at the University of Waterloo. Extremely interesting research showing how you can train self-control amazingly easily.
Mm-hmm. So, ladies and gentlemen, I mean, you know, this has been a real watermark episode. I mean, a man who has probably done more to move us past political correctness and moral relativism and into solutions that are science-based and actually work to everything from, you know, laying the foundation for dealing with gun control, you know, fighting terrorism, improving our schools, and, you know, being able to have more cultural understanding between East and West. Yes, he may have helped prepare us for and prevent World War III between China and America. Ladies and gentlemen, Richard Nisbett, who is the star of his own novel and, you know, walks around the world, and we should all be paying more and more attention to him.
Thank you very much.
And again, all of his books will be in the episode write-up, and I thoroughly recommend reading them all. All right. Thank you so much, Professor.
Thank you.
Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, this has been The Brian Callen Show. Again, The Kid is touring with The Fighter all over the West Coast. I think you've missed most of his dates. But Las Vegas, San Diego, and Hollywood, he will be heading to your neck of the woods. And obviously, I thoroughly endorse seeing both of them because they're both amazing people. All right. Talk to you soon. Bye.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.